Hello everyone. My name is Josh Batkin. I'm the Senior Vice President at the International Code Council for Communications and Marketing. We really appreciate you joining us today. We're trying something a little bit different here at the ICC. We've got this call set up to give professionals in the blogging community sort of an early heads up on our exciting announcement about the new International Green Construction Code. We've got on the phone our CEO, Rick Wyland, who's going to talk to us a little bit more about the code. He's been the CEO of the Code Council since 2006 and been with the organization for longer, 3 years longer than that as well. And he's led us led the effort to develop this code from the staff side, and he's an expert on it. We also have a couple of other ICC experts on the line. We have Dominic Sims, one of our executive vice presidents, and Alan Bilka, who is a senior staff architect. In a moment, I'm going to turn things over to Ron Jones, who is the founder of Green Builder Media. And he's got a long history in this field as well. He chaired our ICC consensus committee that developed the original ICC 700 and has been blogging and writing and following these issues for a long time as well. So we appreciate Ron's help as well. Just a couple of quick ground rules. We've got the phone line open and we have everyone sort of on a listen mode so that Rick and Ron can have their discussions. Ron Jones has some questions, and then the idea was for the community can continue to submit questions to Ron for him to ask on your behalf. So if you haven't already submitted a question you'd like Ron Jones to ask Rick Wyland, please do so at Ron, R-O-N, at thegreenbuilder.com, and he'll be looking at those in real time and adding to his long list. We thought that would be the most efficient and effective way to make sure as many questions got answered as possible. So again, that's Ron at thegreenbuilder.com to submit any additional questions for him. We are going to be recording this call and we'll be transcribing it for future use for you as well. So I wanted to give everyone a heads up about that. With those short brief announcements, thanks to everyone for joining us, and I will turn things over to Ron Jones, the founder of Green Builder Media.
Josh, thank you, and thank you to everyone for joining us today. Most of all, welcome, and thank you to Rick Wyland and Dominic Sims and to Alan Bilka and all the good people at ICC. This is a pretty exciting day because the International Code Council is going to, at long last, have the opportunity to give you a preview of the launch of the International Green Construction Code, the first code of its kind in the history of the world, as far as I know. And so, Rick, let me just start by saying thank you for having me today. And I guess the first question is, what is the International Green Construction Code?
Well, you know, Ron, thanks for, you know, your willingness to moderate this discussion today and for all of your efforts to track and report on what's been happening the last 3 years. You know, it's been about 3 years since the organization, ICC, made the commitment to develop a green construction code for the country. It's something that the board of directors weighed in on. We're very anxious and excited about getting into this green space. Obviously, we've had the IECC, our energy conservation code, since the mid-70s. But this was really an attempt to put together in cooperation with the construction industry, associations representing architects, engineers, you know, green building and illumination, you know, to create an enforceable building code really essentially designed to drive safe and sustainable construction practices. And the beauty of it is that it's been put together in a way that's coordinated with the ICC's family of construction codes, and we'll be releasing it tomorrow, the first final publication. We've had a couple of drafts that have been available, and this is an opportunity to talk about the IGCC and you know, the history towards its development, and why we are here today to launch its what we hope will be a successful adoption throughout the country and conceivably and hopefully around the world.
it's an exciting time for us in the sustainability arena, and I think that it's an opportunity for the first time ever to really see a reconciliation between the approach to the built environment in the context of the natural environment and what's good for people as well. I wonder if you'd indulge me for a second and just let me ask this question. How would you describe the difference for those who are perhaps not totally conversant in the language of the regulatory arena? How would you describe the difference between a code, a standard, and let's say a system, a rating system like LEED, for example? What are the major differences between those three types of documents?
Well, I think, you know, in the scheme of things, that there's probably not a lot of difference between codes and standards per se. Codes, I think we find, get adopted more often. Standards are referenced through the code. And that's why we have created this partnership with a number of organizations, including ASTM International and ASHRAE and others, to become part of this this code development process. The rating systems, for the most part, you know, unless a jurisdiction decides to go in a different direction, are really voluntary in nature. So we have created really a consensus document, a compilation, if you will, of code language referencing various standards that we think are applicable to sustainability, as well as incorporating the various rating systems in the country that have been developed, including USGBC, Green Globes, and others, now in a document that really could form a regulatory framework, if you will, for a jurisdiction that actually wants to adopt and mandate that new construction, existing construction, alterations of existing buildings, now have a regulatory framework which to operate within. And we think that that approach, which really I have to add, Ron, has really come from the ground up, through our membership and building departments throughout the country. As I traveled several years ago, were asking if IGC or if ICC was going to jump into this arena, because they were being asked by their city councils, their mayors, their city managers, to provide the jurisdiction with some kind of regulatory framework for green construction. So, you know, it's taken us a little bit of time to get there, but we think we've got a document now. As I said, it incorporates both applicable standards as well as rating systems that will allow a jurisdiction to now build in a way that is sustainable, and we think that's a good thing.
So the code will provide a platform for public policy for jurisdictions that are interested in a more sustainable building practice, whether it's for existing buildings or for new buildings, new development, and so forth. What is the actual scope of the International Green Construction Code in terms of building types and so on?
Well, it applies to traditional commercial and high-performance buildings. As I mentioned earlier, it is consistent and coordinated with the ICC family of codes and standards, and it's applicable also to the construction of buildings, from all the structural components to the systems, including any alterations and additions to existing buildings. So we've covered that piece, and it has been created in a way where it's designed with the leading rating systems in mind, and then there is a piece that provides some criteria to measure compliance. So it's a fairly broad scope, very comprehensive, and as I said earlier as well, it really has incorporated the best of the best in the industry, from construction industry associations representing architects to engineers, green builders, folks involved with illumination. So we really threw out a pretty big net. We've been very methodical in our approach, numerous public hearings, lots of public input to create this IGCC.
You know, most people revert immediately to the subject of energy when we talk about sustainability and the codes and so forth, but this covers a much broader set of subject areas, doesn't it?
No, that's right. Not only energy, but materials, resource and water efficiency, indoor environmental quality, site design, as I said, existing building retrofits, and there's also a chapter in there about building and site operation and maintenance documentation. So it covers what we think are the critical subject areas for sustainable construction.
And this is in the same framework, if you will, so that it's compatible and translatable to the existing set of codes that have been developed over time?
Yeah, that's one of the concepts, I think, when the first group got together to sort of scope out what would be included in the IGCC, they developed a sort of a mantra of it needs to be effective, enforceable, and adoptable. And they talked about addressing minimum as well as advanced levels of performance. And obviously, as a part of this development process through our co-development process, we wanted to make sure that it was fully integrated with the rest of the I codes, which I think we've accomplished. It's also written in mandatory language, which gives us that regulatory framework. And it does also provide both performance prescriptive and pre-engineered solutions. And the other thing I think, Ron, it's also important to mention, like the I codes, we allow for jurisdictions to account for local conditions, and we think that's also extremely important, especially when it comes to the adoptability of the code itself.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that a code could be developed that would have a one-size-fits-all quality that could reach across all of the different climate zones and regions of the country, and even cultural significant differences that are in play. I wonder if we could drill just for a moment on you mentioned mandatory language, and so for the uninitiated or for those of us who are really not in the code enforcement arena, is this a tool then that allows the policymaker to make it very clear to the code official and to the inspectors precisely what they are required to do? Is that what we mean by mandatory language?
If a jurisdiction decides that it wants this to be a mandatory approach, obviously it's written with that language in mind. And we've had a lot of adoptions prior to this final release, that have been both mandatory on some sides and voluntary on others. I think that just allows some flexibility at the local level. As this is fairly new, the whole movement towards sustainable construction, sometimes jurisdictions may approach this in a way where it becomes a, if you want to build green, here's how you could do it. Our hope is, because I think there's a good economic argument to make, and there's a sort of a public responsibility argument to make, this, because it's written in mandatory language, could be, could and probably should be adopted in a mandatory way, so that we continue to improve our building stock in this country. Energy is obviously a big issue and remains one and will continue to be one in the foreseeable future. And there are a lot of pieces within this document that not only reference the IECC, which is in itself a green code when it comes to energy efficiency, But you know, we have a real opportunity here in building our new buildings in a much more sustainable way. And one of the things I also think is really quite interesting is that you know, there really isn't a huge difference in terms of the increase in the average life cycle cost of a green building, and that's due because there's such a greater availability of materials available than there were, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So the savings, you know, stemming from lower operating costs, lower energy usage, in some respects, higher property values. There are a lot of studies out there that have shown that green construction really does not cost any more than traditional construction. So why not make it mandatory?
Absolutely, especially over the long haul. And just one other sort of point of specificity here. You talked about the fact that the code provides different solutions, that is performance-based, prescriptive-based, and pre-engineered. Just in layman's terms, can you expand on that just a little bit?
Well, yeah, I think there's been a lot of controversy over, you know, various efforts out there to green construction in terms of maybe what the code says or what the rating system proposes or whatever the standards that are being used. And, you know, to allow a jurisdiction the opportunity to look, whether it's on the performance side or the prescriptive side, or on the pre-engineered side, it gives them maximum flexibility to figure out how they really want to make this work in their jurisdiction. And you know, we think that you know, sort of that opportunity really gives us the flexibility, or the jurisdiction the flexibility to really do what they think is best for their jurisdiction.
Very good, thank you. I know that earlier you had indicated that there were other significant organizations that had contributed from the very beginning and at stages along the way in supporting the ICC in this effort. Do you want to expand a little bit on that?
Well, when the board of directors made the decision to move forward on developing the Green Code, we reached out to the American Institute of Architects and ASTM International initially as part of our group that would be what we called at the time cooperating sponsors. You know, and there are a number of other groups that have joined that effort, including ASHRAE, the U.S. Green Building Council, and the Illuminating Engineering Society. So we had a very strong contingent of organizations, you know, in the industry, in the codes and standards, construction related industry, at the table from almost the very beginning of the process. So I think that kind of support early on from AIA and ASTM really gave us, outside of ICC's own credibility, additional credibility to bring other people to the table. And that's what we accomplished. And I think the more people who have a stake in this, who have some expertise in sustainable practices when it comes to constructing buildings, you know, the more I think the better code we ended up being able to produce, and I think also looking forward, our ability to get this code actually used in states and jurisdictions throughout the country. I think it was critical to getting this thing launched.
I think you're absolutely right. Let's talk a little bit about the actual, if you don't mind, the actual makeup of the organization itself, ICC. You have a very large and diverse membership of your own.
Yeah, we do. I mean, we're about a 50,000 member organization made up of code officials and design professionals, manufacturers. Our codes are actually adopted now in all 50 states and over 20,000 jurisdictions. So we've got about 320 some people who work every day for ICC. It's a pretty incredible family, very dedicated employees who really believe in this mission of building a safer, more sustainable world. And I think our foray now into the green space is the next chapter for ICC in many respects. I think we're excited to be there. Our hope is that this code will get a lot of traction. We're in the process, I might add, of we've not only created a number of training and certification programs, but a lot of other efforts are underway to develop more products and support services that'll make it possible and perhaps easier for the enforcement of this code to occur at the ground level. So, we've got a lot of folks and a lot of resources dedicated to ensuring that the IGCC is a success.
I couldn't agree more. The number that I recall is that approximately 80% of the buildings that are designed and constructed in the country today are under ICC jurisdiction. Is that right?
That's probably about right. I like to use the 50 states and 20-some thousand jurisdictions, but we have a family of codes, everything from commercial buildings that are built to the International Building Code to residential construction that are built to the IRC, the International Residential Code, to plumbing and mechanical codes, fire codes. That whole family, is really, adopted all around the country. Obviously, there are a few other codes that we compete with, and that's fine as well. But we do see ICC, especially on the construction side, as being the preeminent code for the country.
The you had made a reference, Rick, to the fact that there are some jurisdictions that have already adopted some version of the code or some earlier draft perhaps. And I was wondering, are there existing projects that have used the code? My understanding is that there may have been some projects that already had served as test cases for the code.
Well, there is a project in Arizona, it's called the Northeast Arizona Technological Institute of Vocational Education. In Kayenta Township, Arizona, it was built, a section of their school there was built using the IGCC, and it was completed, I think it was late last year in 2011. They used the public version 2.0 as their base document. There are a number of other jurisdictions that have either adopted it or in the process of adopting it, and there's a whole list I think we've got posted on our website that references from the state of Florida to Phoenix, Scottsdale, Arizona. I actually made a visit to Richland, Washington early last year, I believe. They were one of the first major jurisdictions in the country to actually adopt the IGCC. They adopted it as a non-mandatory document for commercial buildings, but nonetheless, they were really the first out of the chute. And I had told the staff that they're the first jurisdiction to adopt. I really wanted to go there and personally thank them for jumping in. And Richland happened to be that jurisdiction. I found memories of my visit there. It was really a celebration, and I think sort of a vision of what was to come. So we've got as I said, several jurisdictions. Keene, New Hampshire, jumped on board not that long ago. The state of Rhode Island, they have the what they call the Rhode Island Green Buildings Act, which identifies the IGCC as an equivalent standard. You know, there's just good news all the way around the country. Maryland just recently jumped in and adopted the IGCC as a mandatory document. So we expect to see a lot of this now, especially with this final document now available that's gone through our entire process. We expect there'll be a lot of states and jurisdictions jumping on board.
I assume that that Josh and the other folks on the staff there, if they haven't already, will make that fact sheet and the list of jurisdictions available to the folks who are good enough to join us on the call today. And I would also assume that there will be an ongoing update of jurisdictions. Does that typically appear on your main website, or
absolutely,
how would you keep track?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the best advertising that we could do would be to track all the adoptions that are occurring around the country in the IGCC, so that jurisdictions not only can see what's happening, but maybe even reach out to those jurisdictions to see why and how they're applying the IGCC in their communities.
Let's go back to the question about the difference between the IGCC or a code in general with other systems or standards, rating systems like LEED or Green Globes or standards that might already be adopted by a jurisdiction somewhere, and not so much to drill on the differences between them or to try to compare one to the other, but from the standpoint of the adoptability and the compatibility and how they can coexist within a certain jurisdiction. How does ICC approach that?
Well, the code itself, I mean, the IGCC is really an overlay to the rest of our code. So they've got an opportunity to pick pieces that they think that have some application in their jurisdiction. As I said earlier, you know, just the flexibility that we've created within the IGCC really, I think, you know, ensures that jurisdiction can do really what they think is best. And I think that, you know, being cognizant of, I think one of the reasons we've had so much traction with our other codes is we acknowledge, I mean, our preference obviously would be to adopt our codes as they've been proposed through our consensus process. But you have to, you really have to allow for, you know, some flexibility at the local level. And it goes back to your comment, it's not one size fits all. So we really, we think we've met that goal in the IGCC, and we think that it'll be well received at the local level.
Let's talk a little bit about how the code was actually developed. What is the process by which the ICC came to be?
Well, you, as you know, and for our folks out there that are listening in and wondering, you know, we have been a consolidated organization since 2003. Prior to that, there were three legacy organizations, all servicing regions of the country. We have what we call a governmental consensus process, where we bring, and it's very open to the public, to all interest groups who come together on a very frequent basis to take what may be an existing code and offer changes based on new science, lessons learned from building failures, natural disasters. And those hearings allow individuals to propose changes to the document. And that goes through a pretty grueling process. There are various committees that are involved, as well as these public hearings. By the way, we have one coming up in Dallas next month where people can come and participate in this code development process. But through all of that, at the end of the day, and this is what I think really makes ICC unique, is that we allow all this input, but at the end of the day, it's really the governmental member the governmental representative that's designated by the jurisdiction who has the final say of what goes in the code. And we think that's important because, you know, their interest really is only the public interest, not any particular special interest other than the public interest. And even though we allow all this input and create what we hope is a consensus document, that's the backstop to making sure that really it's the public interest that's at heart here, and our governmental members really at the end of the process get to weigh in and make that determination. I think as a result of that, it's the reason we've had such wide adoptions throughout the country of our ICC family of codes, and the IGCC went through that process. So we don't see this any differently.
Did you find that there was a pent-up appetite, if you will, for a set of green codes? It seems like there were certain jurisdictions, certain parts of the country, and certain sectors that were really clamoring for an update in terms of sustainability and green construction. Do you think that's accurate?
I really think that is. I mean, I remember numerous encounters. I travel a lot around the country and meet with our chapter organizations. And I know 4 or 5 years ago, I was getting pummeled with requests in terms of, you know, what's ICC going to do about, green construction, sustainable construction practices, because they were getting pushed, a lot of our members were getting pushed by their local jurisdictions. And what you had developing in the country was this real hodgepodge, a checkerboard of activity to regulate green construction, but there was no consistency from one city to the next, one county to the next, one state to the next. So it was pretty obvious, I think, at the time that, ICC, as a public nonprofit with a mission, to build safer buildings, had a real responsibility and an opportunity to jump in here and provide this regulatory framework so that there could be some consistency from state to state, from coast to coast, and that's I think where we ended up, and that's what we'll be providing tomorrow with the first release of the final document.
Is it fair to say that demand continues to increase, or has it diminished in the time that we've been working?
You know, that's a good question, Ron. I do think that the economy has slowed a lot of things down in terms of. Well, even in terms of code adoptions, but the economy is on a slow recovery, and I think in the final analysis, if we can make the case that really the life cycle cost is really negligible, that and that this is a smart thing for our country to be doing when it comes to, if you just want to isolate as an issue, energy efficiency. And our dependence on fossil fuel, foreign oil, that part of our solution is conservation in terms of a national energy policy, and this sort of fits right in. And I think as the economy continues to recover, and we continue to focus as a nation on energy independence. Buildings and what they consume, and you've all heard the 40% of fossil fuels and the carbon footprint that it leaves. We've got a real opportunity here with the IGCC to lessen our dependence and decrease those carbon emissions. So, I don't think that I look at that as a conservation as being a very sort of conservative, thought, a very conservative ideology. It's not Democrat or Republican or liberal or conservative. It just makes a lot of sense from so many different aspects.
I think from our point of view, as we've observed this process and we've observed the evolution toward a more sustainable model, it's become apparent that more people realize now that first cost is not full cost, and that the investment up front that helps to create a more sustainable built environment does facilitate a number of advantages, like that security that you just alluded to, and other areas as well, in terms of you mentioned indoor environment quality. The information that we continue to gather from the consumer, from the public, is that in addition to energy and concerns about water, indoor environment quality is very high on their list of concerns. And so I think that it's important that people realize and appreciate how comprehensive a green construction code had to be. And I think that may have been one of the greatest challenges to the Code Council in trying to make this development come about.
Yeah, and you know, and you can't underestimate, you know, even as the economy is slowly recovering, is that, you know, there have been studies and articles written in terms of, you know, green construction and its impact on the economy. It actually creates jobs, you know, and it adds, you know, billions of dollars to the U.S. economy. I mean, as I said earlier, there are all these new materials and this new science that has sprung up, you know, where we can do this in a very cost-effective way. And, you know, I am always concerned about, you know, we try to recycle at ICC. You know, we've got our own green strategy as an organization. You know, I bet most of us on this phone probably recycle at home. Maybe your jurisdiction requires that you recycle. So the material depletion that's going on, I mean, this is in part, you know, an opportunity to address some of that. Our headquarters in Washington, D.C. is in a LEED certified building. You know, it really is a phenomenal structure. You know, most of, if not all, materials there are recycled. It's a beautiful building, and we've got an opportunity to build sustainable buildings, you know, moving forward with this code, and to, as we do rehabs, alterations, additions to the existing building stock in this country, we now have a code that will allow us to do that in a very sustainable way. And I just think it's pretty exciting stuff for ICC and for the country.
That allows us to sort of segue into perhaps talking about the difference between the model code and what we would refer to as a national or federal mandate. What do you see as the difference?
Well, you know, we've got, I mean, there are obviously been efforts at the federal level to mandate, you know, certain efficiencies, in particular, you know, in terms of the energy concerns and how much buildings consume in terms of energy. You know, the IGC is really a model code. You know, it requires adoption by governing jurisdictions before it even becomes a law. So in this way, that language, if necessary, can be adapted to address some of the flexibility at the local level versus, you know, some kind of federal mandate that, you know, all too often sometimes is one size fits all. And so we produced a regulatory framework that essentially allows for publicly elected legislative bodies to really have the final voice in what they want to include. And it's very much like the rest of our I-codes. They're adopted in some states without amendment, and in others, you know, there are amended versions, which gives the state and the local jurisdiction that flexibility. So I think that in most part is how the IGCC differs from a national or federal mandate. We give state and local governments some flexibility.
Mr. Well, Jones, I think we have time for one more question.
It happens that I just have one more. I was going to say my final question is that so far we've talked about the IGCC in the context of commercial buildings. And I know that people are interested to know how it applies to residential buildings, because that's a very large component of the built environment. So can you tell us a little bit about the relationship between the IGCC and the residential sector?
Well, we do reference IGCC or the ICC 700 standard, which was an effort that ICC embarked on with the National Association of Home Builders and others to create a standard for residential construction. So it is part of the IGCC. There have been some modifications through this code development process, and without getting into a lot of the specifics, it does attempt to include all what is called group R3 residential occupancies of any height and group R2 and R4 occupancies that are four stories or less in height, as well as the detached one and two family dwellings. So there is the ICC 700 standard that's part of the IGCC. So there's an opportunity if the jurisdiction wants to mandate or offer in a voluntary way the 700 standard, that they'll be able to do that. I also might add that, on the commercial side, ASHRAE's 189.1 is part of the IGCC. There was a change made just recently which allows the permit holder to determine whether or not they want to use the IGCC or the 189, so it gives them that flexibility. You know, as you can see, there's a common theme through all of this conversation today, and that is, we've created this base code, this sort of minimum document that has all these various levels, depending on where the jurisdiction wants to go, whether it's, to the higher end and, the sort of platinum level of maybe a LEED, the LEED rating system or the Green Globes rating system, to, ASHRAE's 189 standard. But that flexibility, I think, will get us the traction we need to really start creating a more sustainable built environment in this country.
Hopefully so. Well, Rick, and all the folks at ICC, again, thank you for the opportunity to take part in this dialogue. And all I can say is that I can't wait to see jurisdictions across the country adopt the IGCC as soon as possible.
Well, I appreciate it. And thank you, Ron. And thanks to everybody who joined us today and were interested enough to sign on and submit your questions. You can find out, there's a lot of information on our website, which is www.iccsafe.org. You should find it. It's very available about the IGCC and other things that are going on within the International Code Council.
Great. Thank you very much. And follow up with me at jbatkin@iccsafe.org. Thank you, Mr. Weiland. Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.